session number 10496, Reel 2.
We lost 50 airmen, a very large proportion of the total white casualties, and one of the reasons for this was the construction of the single-storey huts in which they lived. The ceilings were made of wire netting with cow dung plaster spread over them and then whitewashed. And when the buildings, which were not very substantial, came down, the ceilings came down whole and suffocated the poor chaps as they lay in their beds, and hampered the movements of those who were sufficiently well to be able to try and get out. It was an odd incident. It was a very, very precise line between one point where there was an earthquake and another point where there wasn't. And it happened that the Army Staff College was the, what you might say, called the good side of the line. And they did not know what had happened during the night, although they knew, obviously, there was commotion. And they came down to the camp as arranged to be watch a demonstration, all in their natty uniform, not knowing what was going on.
Did you get to know Slessor very well?
No, he wasn't all that easy to get to know, and we dispersed, you see, after the earthquake. It took about, a fortnight to get all the flyable aeroplanes away. We cannibalized unmercifully between aeroplanes. One smashed rudder would be replaced from another one, and, you know, that sort of thing. You finish up with an irreducible minimum. And that took about a fortnight, and I never saw him again for a long time. I have a very charming note from his wife, which I treasure.
Why was he not easy to get to know?
Just his personality, I think. Well, maybe I'm exaggerating. He was a wing commander and I was a pilot officer, and there's a very big gap, certainly in those days.
Can we jump ahead to the war now?
Sure.
And the outbreak of war?
Yeah.
Did you actually hear Chamberlain's broadcast that we were at war with Germany?
Well, if you like, I can go back one year to our
yes.
funny little incident, which happened to I was an old sailor back in 16 Squadron again. And one night, a message came through after the end of working hours to say that the war minister was going to be on the airfield at such and such a time and had to get back to London in a great hurry. And would we have two aeroplanes, one for him and one for his staff officer, standing by? And I happened to be the orderly officer, and I reported this to the duty flight lieutenant, and we decided we'd do this duty ourselves. So we got it all lined up, and it got later and later and darker, and we didn't want to do a night flight if we could help it. However, they did turn up, and we levered these two gents into the rear cockpit of an Audax, two Audaxes, which was a pretty restricted space. And this duty flight lieutenant, Dougie Andrews, and I took off for Heston, which is where they wanted to go. And when we got there, we went into an office where there was a telephone, which was the first demand. They wanted a telephone. And they rang 10 Downing Street, which was great excitement for us, you know. But we were quickly shepherded out of the room and never knew what happened. But we smelt drama in the air, and instead of going home at 8 o'clock the next morning, having completed our task, we hung about, and we actually saw Churchill waving his bit of paper.
Chamberlain.
Yes.
Can you describe the scene?
Not very well. The things I remember most are the quite small crowd round him, but an awful lot of policemen, mainly out of sight, behind buildings and things like that. We were high up in some way, I can't remember how now, and we could see behind walls, you know. I would have thought the crowd was quite small. I suppose mainly reporters and such.
How did they react to his waving the piece of paper?
Well, we couldn't hear. We couldn't hear anything. We were too far away for that. And we never really knew until we sort of read it in the newspapers what had gone on. But we did see this great event.
So you weren't conscious that it was a great historical occasion?
Not really, not until afterwards. You just smelt it in the air. I think it's Hoare or Hoare Belasho was the chap at the time. And that, I can give you a date for that one. That took place on the 23rd of September, according to my logbook, 1938, that would be, wouldn't it?
Yes. Now, can we go on to the outbreak of war?
Sure.
And did you hear the famous broadcast on the 3rd of September?
Yes, I did. One had anticipated something of the kind, and sort of vague imaginings had gone through one's mind as to what the differences would be. Would the air be full of hostile aircraft? Would we be doing the same sort of things we'd been doing for ever or what?
Where were you when you heard the broadcast?
At Andover. I'd been posted to the 41 group at that time. And as I remember, my wife to be, or were we married? Wife to be was having a drink with me in the mess. You know, happened about 11 o'clock in the morning, didn't it?
Yes.
And one sort of said, "Well, that's it, I'll take you home." And came back and twiddled one's thumbs. What did one do? We've broken wars on. What do you do? And no one had told us what to do.
Was there a sense of depression, or were people elated, or what?
Well, it was strictly non-operational place, this. 41 Group was a brand new group invented for the war. Yeah, and it was really only just forming, and it was full of equipment officers. There was no operational flying took place, or then there were no, I was probably about the only aviator there, I should think. So that there was not that kind of reason to be emotional about it.
You had already at that stage, in fact as far back as 1936, become a specialist in signals.
Yeah.
Can you tell me the work that an RF signals specialist does?
Yes. Well, I became, that was how I got my PC. You had to specialise in something to get your permanent commission. And I chose signals for one reason only, and that was, it was the only specialisation which got you back to a squadron. if you became an engineer or a photographer or whatever, you became a station man. If you became a signaller, you might go back to a squadron proper and become a member of a flight just like anybody else. And that's why I became a signaller, really. And it worked. As far as the Army Cooperation Squadron was concerned, your tasks were maintenance on the one side. You were responsible for all the radio carried in the aeroplanes themselves, and the ground end of the channel, which was, in our case, mobile, because it was supposed to trundle around behind the army. And that was really the sum total of the thing, making the stuff operational and keeping it operational. And the failure rate was the big thing that one always fought against. You didn't want failures in the air. People had enough to contend with in the air without having faulty communications to the ground. We were, being on a station, our point-to-point communications were provided by and large by the station itself, unless we were detached, in which case we used to do a bit of radio communication. WT, chaps with a key, all very, very primitive and modest. You had about 30 people to do that, 30 airmen, under a flight sergeant.
Once the war broke out, can you explain to me how signals equipment developed and improved?
Yes. I was not well placed in this respect. Army Corporation was a Cinderella of the worst kind, and I spent a lot of my time trying to get second best equipment, because I knew damn well I would not get the best, and so that I was very much on the fringes of development. But I did maintain a growing contact with the people at Telecommunications Research Establishment, TRE, because they were very sympathetic to operational requirements, and it was always helpful to talk to them about what would be nice to have, you know. The worst shortage we ever had was reasonable air-to-ground communication, the basic requirement. And we were reduced to taking an army set called a 19 set and adapting that and putting it into our aeroplanes, because it was quite impossible to get the same equipment as Fighter Command had, which was VHF. Which relatively new at the beginning of the war, and that was just not available for aircraft which weren't in the front line,
because there was just not enough to go around.
I guess so. You've got sympathy and damn little else. Later on, of course, things changed and it became more and more sophisticated.
How did you find the 19 sets worked?
Well, they were a lot better than anything we'd had, but they were very limited in their range and power. But
and
they
their
were
reliability?
The reliability wasn't bad, not bad.
One imagines the 19 sets of those days as being huge. Can you describe them?
Well, they'd be about 20 inches long and about 10 inches in each of the other dimensions, I would say. They were no difficulty to fit from the bulk point of view at all. They were probably a bit heavier, having been designed to be thrown about on the ground. They are heavier than they need have been.
Can you describe how they worked? Because I'm sure most people would not have the slightest idea.
Well, they were not VHF, they were on the lower frequency range, and they were speech communication, the ordinary RT, and the ground stations at first were mobile things, but they would I don't remember too much about that end of it.
You said that 41 group was specially formed.
Yeah.
Can you tell me the background to that?
Yes, the aircraft, the airfields had been growing long before the war broke out. They'd started the process of making airfields. They also obviously anticipated the production of vast numbers of aircraft, and somebody decided that it was worthwhile having a maintenance group, a support group, which did nothing but look after aircraft in store. And I should think at least a dozen aircraft were designated aircraft storage units. And these are the airfields which you can probably still see to this day, which have a wide low hangar, which had about 3 foot of earth on top of it, and was reasonably safe from blast and small stuff. And these were dotted about the whole country, in Scotland, over in around the Lancashire, Gloucestershire, certainly. And I filled my time here. It's really very underemployed. I filled my time in arranging the ordinary telephone communications for these things, going and meeting the post offices on the spot, deciding where the cables best go and who, what telephone extensions would be needed around the place, and exchanges and so on. Very underemployed. Didn't last very long.
As the war developed, you said that the equipment improved.
Yeah.
What improvements in equipment did you get, and at what stage?
Yes. I was trying to think when we did get VHF for communications.
Was it before or after D-Day?
Well, we'd ceased to exist as Army Cooperation then. Army Cooperation had been a group in fighter command. Then in 1941 or thereabouts, they made an Army Cooperation Command on its own. And this did its best to try and develop cooperation with the Army in the line of the growing modern view of requirements. And it soldiered on until nearly the end of the war, when it was translated overnight to be 2nd Tactical Air Force, based at Bracknell. And by that time, they had really become fighters. we had the master in the Army Corps command period. We had Mustangs, which had the quality of prodigious endurance. They would stay up in the air for about 5 hours. And Army Corporation pilots were the ones who really invented the train bashing business, long, deep penetration into enemy territory at very low heights and shooting up trains and other targets of opportunity. And that was made possible by the long endurance of these things. They did very well and got very little credit for it.
What was the main problem in attacking a train?
I don't know. I never did it. I doubt if there was a special problem from attacking the train itself. Your main problem would be to stay alive, to avoid being attacked yourself and detected yourself. If you were low enough, you had a better chance of non-detection, you know.
Because of the radar screen.
Yes. If you could keep under that and change course frequently and so on.
I think you were involved with... You've put here that you were involved with the signals plans for Overlord,
yes.
The invasion of Normandy.
Yes.
What did that involve as far as you were concerned?
Well, that was a very, very exciting posting. I had been posted to 2nd TAF by that time as Deputy Chief Signal Officer plans, and they were at Uxbridge. And I was detached with a squadron leader and a clerk to Hammersmith, St. Paul's School, which was to be Montgomery's headquarters for 21 Army Group. And I was part of a small RAF cell whose duty it was to make the plans for the invasion and liaise like mad with the army to make sure it all fitted in. That was headed up by a group captain, as he was then, Pat Fraser. He's finished up a chief marshal, quite a big shot. And we literally sat down with clean sheets of paper and wrote basic orders, not the sort of instructions which would be given within a squadron or, you know, by the signal officer or within a station by the signal officer, but the more overall kind of thing, and things which have to be done centrally, like the allocation of frequencies for communication and the allocation of call signs. Well, these sort of things have to be done centrally, and there are many others which need coordination. There are maintenance plans, rules and regulations to be followed. It was a new force, you know, and I didn't keep my book. I think I told you. Did I mention the letter that I had? I didn't keep my copy. It was top secret. And
no, I don't think you did mention.
Didn't I was working for Air Marshal Porter, Chief Marshal Porter, and I saw him the other day, and he told me he kept a copy of his. I didn't dare do that.
You were ordered not to.
Well, it was a very secret document at the time, obviously, because all this was 6 months ahead of the event. It fascinated me that a clerk, and in my case just a clerk, but multiplied out many, many clerks, and people of that level of education, intelligence, or whatever you like to call it, there must have been an enormous number of people who knew 6 months ahead where we were going to land, and yet nobody blew it. And I thought that was astonishing.
When you say where we were going to land,
yeah.
did they just know Normandy, or did they know it more
specifically? The degree of definition grew a bit as time went on, but by and large we knew precisely. The radars which were to go in were sighted with that 8-figure reference. That brings them down to about 10 yards.
An 8-figure map reference?
Yeah.
On a grid?
Yes. Their sites had been selected by aerial photography and all the sort of things like that.
So you knew 6 months before that it was going to be Normandy?
Yeah. And quite a lot of people must have known at that time. And it was remarkable that nobody blew it.
And did you know when it was going to occur?
More or less.
What were the main problems that you had in doing this kind of work then? Did it throw up any?
Well, it was in very much a liaison job with 2nd AF headquarters, who knew the operational side of where the squadrons were going to operate from, where they were going to move to on the continent when the airfields had very quickly been made, all that sort of stuff. The operational side is what governs the signal side, and a little bit what the signals can do governs what the operational people can do. You know, they're a little bit mutual. And so it was all an immense amount of traffic, verbal traffic, between myself and the CSO. And I would go and talk to him for half a day and get the form on such and such a matter, and then go home and write it up, and eventually we covered the waterfront.
How did this verbal traffic, what form did this verbal traffic take?
Visiting. I would quickly go out there. Didn't take much time. It wasn't difficult from Hammersmith to Uxbridge, you know.
Not on telephones?
No. You were very, very conscious of the dangers of that. Yeah.
So you were very security conscious?
Very.
Did you come into contact with Americans much at this time?
Not a lot.